Get up, BDL. It's time for the Can-Am Super Show, brought to you by Mike and Scotty. Coming up on today's show, the 2025 BDL Draft is in the books. The Mounties, with their first ever number one overall selection, are now the proud owners of Roki Sasaki. So congrats to Canada. The Great White North needed a win after the Blue Jays blew it, but the Sasaki-Canada connection was not to be denied after all. Plus, we're gearing up for another BDL season. Spring training is only days away at this point, and the race is already on to see who hits the ground running next month here in the BDL. Plus, there's another race happening this year in the Black Diamond League, one of historic proportions, one that will see two all-time great BDL owners attempt to reach a milestone no other owner has ever reached. How's that for a teaser? Special thanks to Brian of the Crawford Cramps for joining today's show to talk about history being made this summer in the BDL, at least we think. The Can-Am Super Show is brought to you, the Can-Am Super Show is proudly hosted on Captivate, our podcast home on the web. To catch each and every episode of the podcast, subscribe to our feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Downcast, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to interact with the show, the easiest way to do that is by giving us a shout on X at Can-Am Super Show. We're active every single day on X, and we'd love to hear from you. Thanks for checking out the pod today, guys. You are listening to the BDL Podcast Network. Here comes the Super Show. Hello again, all you fantasy baseball maniacs, especially those who call the Black Diamond League home. Thank you so much for making the Can-Am Super Show part of your day once again. Mike, my friend, would it be improper to start with the Pledge of Allegiance to Luka Doncic and the new era of greatness in Los Angeles?
You know what? It's ridiculous how this seems to happen like every 10 years with your stupid Lakers. Someone just gifts you guys a superstar. Like it was Pau Gasol, I guess, was the last one where, you know, you guys traded what was called at the time the poo-poo platter by Bill Simmons to get Pau Gasol. And then you got Shaq in free agency and Kobe falls in your lap for Vlade Divac and, you know, going back to friggin' Will Chamberlain, I guess.
Wait a minute. I'll just push back. Kobe didn't fall in our laps. Kobe was scouted
and developed. I get it. I'm a basketball purist. I'm just trying to make the point of every decade you guys seem to come up with some generational talent. And part of it is great leadership and fantastic development. And some of it apparently is just blind luck where the GM of the Mavericks just happened to have your number first in his Rolodex and called you guys up and your GM is like, you want to do what? Okay, we'll do that. And it's a hell of a deal for you guys. I don't know what the hell the Mavericks are thinking, but it is one hell of a deal for the Lakers. And I think he's a young guy who's been like top five in the MVP vote like every year of his career. So why wouldn't you trade him?
Makes perfect sense. Right?
Yeah, it's logical. Yeah, it's like I'm trying to think of a baseball comp, but I really can't think of one top of my head. I can't think of one. But it's the equivalent of call a guy up and he's an MVP candidate for 4 or 5 straight years. And then you trade him even though he's agreed to an extension. Can't think of that name.
I mean, this is not the same. It's not a perfect comp at all. I mean, the Mookie Betts trade, was that?
You know what? That's what I was thinking. But the difference with Betts was the Red Sox didn't think they were going to sign him. So imagine that deal if Betts' agent had already told him, yeah, we'll sign whatever contract you offer me. And they still traded him. That's effectively what the Mavericks did on that deal, because he was going to sign. He was happy where he was. They just didn't want to commit to him for – I don't understand. Again, I've been a basketball fan since I was about 5 or 6 years old, and once every 10 years a trade happens where you just look at it and you're like, this is a joke, right? And it seems every time that happens, the Lakers are on the other end of it. So, yeah, it's good news for your Lakers. Good news.
I mean, I'll take it.
You know, I don't blame you. It's what's funny is I saw one imbecile on Twitter, apparently a Laker fan, complaining on how they got fleeced, and I almost died laughing. Really? You got fleeced? So, you know, Anthony Davis is a star, and it's like, yeah, he is. And he's hurt half the time, and he's a few years older than Luka is. And it's like unless you are a family member of Anthony Davis, you should love that trade. That's basically what it comes down to.
Well, for those of you who have not tuned out at this point, listening to NBA coverage here on the Can-Am Super Show, thank you for still being with us.
We do that every once in a while, don't we?
Every now and then.
Yeah.
I mean, I love my Lakers. I love talking about my Lakers, but I understand that's not exactly our audience here.
No, it's not.
We will move on. You know, Mike, it's, of course, as we record this, right now it's the early start of Super Bowl weekend. Here on this Friday night, the Chiefs.
Don't get me started on this.
Well, I just want to make. I mean, let's just chat about it. I mean, we'll move on. We won't hang around on this topic for too long. But you know, we need to acknowledge the fact that the Chiefs are preparing to do something that the Rockland Rockets could not pull off, and that's win 3 straight championships.
You're making it worse. Full disclosure, I'm a fan of the Buffalo Bills, and I had to sit through the officials winning the AFC Championship game once again. Again, I am not one to blame officials. When that game ended, I was on a chat with my brother and a couple other guys, and I was actually very fair-minded about it and said, listen, the Chiefs had the ball twice at the end of the game, and we couldn't stop them. And we had the ball twice, and they stopped us once, and that was the difference. Here's the problem with social media, Scotty, is for the next 24 hours, I saw every horrible call replayed over and over and over again. And I went from the officials weren't that bad to – I went from that to this game is friggin' rigged, and I hope all the officials get in car accidents on the way home from this game. It just went like, you know, the couple of bad calls I noticed turned into like 10 that I did not notice over the course of the game. And it's like, ugh. But I don't know. Like, I don't like the Chiefs. I'm not a huge fan of the Eagles. This actually reminds me of a story. I know you are not a big soccer fan.
No.
But I was at work years and years ago, and I can't remember if it was the World Cup or the European Championships. It really doesn't matter. But I'm of Italian background, and Italians do not like the English soccer team, and we do not like the Portuguese soccer team. This is just a cultural thing. And it was lunchtime, and Portugal was playing England. The game was on at like 12 o'clock. So I walk into our lunchroom. I wasn't planning to watch the game. But a bunch of the guys who were watching the game turned and saw me, and they know my feelings about the English and the Portuguese national soccer clubs. And one of the guys looks at me and says, well, this should be interesting. Who are you cheering for today, Mike? And I said, well, isn't it obvious? And he said, and he looks at me, and I believe this guy was English who asked me. He said, you're cheering for England? I'm not cheering for England. And he said, you're not cheering for Portugal, are you? No. He said, who are you cheering for? I'm cheering for Al-Qaeda. And he's you are a horrible human being. Yes, I am. Have a good lunch, everybody. And I walked out of the room. This is almost how I feel about this Super Bowl. I don't hate the Eagles, but I really don't care for the Eagles. And as much as I don't have the hatred of the Chiefs that I do, I don't want them winning another one. I've had quite enough of Kermit the Frog and the rest of his team winning championship after championship. I've had enough of them winning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really just not the biggest NFL fan there is anyway. So when it comes to the NFL playoffs, which I do pay attention to and watch, and especially the Super Bowl, you know, what I root for is simply entertainment. And I know the quickest way to that in this game is watching the rest of the rest of North America, I guess, melt down if the Chiefs win yet again. So that's clearly how I'm rooting, you know, in this situation, because I just want to be entertained by this.
Yes. The best part of the Super Bowl is, for the first time in I don't know how many years, the sitting president is going to be at the game. So that's going to have add even more intrigue to this game. I can only imagine how much fun that's going to be.
I had not even –
You did not know that?
I did not know that. No.
Yes, he's going to be there. So that'll make this even more interesting.
Well, super.
I wonder what the response will be, because he's offered at UFC events and gets standing ovations.
Which
thinks it's not going to be the same at the Super Bowl, but we shall see.
Which – and I know this doesn't really matter with the Super Bowl. It's a very transient event, but – Which city is the Super Bowl in this year?
I want to say it's in New Orleans, but I could be wrong.
Huh, okay.
I think it's in New Orleans, though.
Well, yeah, that at least that will be entertainment. One way or another, that will be a car wreck to watch. So
yeah, it is at the Caesars Superdome in New Orleans. Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, we will move right off of that subject before we lose any more listeners today. Mm-hmm. And Mike, we'll move right into the first of the two primary topics for today's show here on the Super Show. Of course, recently concluded the annual BDL draft, more or less our first year player draft. Of course, it's really a catch-all draft, so any available player, but the primary focus always, as we know, is on first-year eligible players. And the Mounties, having acquired the first overall pick in this year's draft from the Wallabies, took advantage of that situation very clearly, drafting the top guy on the board after he signed with the Dodgers there very shortly before our draft. Of course, I'm referring to Roky Sasaki. Mm-hmm. 23, I believe, year old arm now with the Dodgers that the Mounties have locked down for however long Steven chooses to rely on his services. So, I mean, I think clearly in any first-year player draft this year in fantasy, the number one choice.
Yeah, the obvious one.
Yep, agreed. At number two overall, J.J. Weatherholt to the Wallabies over Travis Bezina at 1.2. The Wallabies, I think, maybe zagging a little bit with this shortstop selection. When I think the popular thought was that Bezina was the choice here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm off base. Now, having said that, I actually don't necessarily disagree with that zag. I'm a big fan of Weatherholt's game. I think he will be a quality major league player. And I think the Wallabies actually did make the correct choice here.
The thing that got me about this draft, Scotty, and maybe it's just me, and everybody knows I'm not the most draft-focused GM in our league.
You don't say.
This draft did not excite me at all. Like, J.J. Weatherholt is a guy who I would expect to go, like, in a good draft, somewhere around pick 10. Like, the fact he was a choice at number two just screams to me, like, this ain't a really good draft. Like, this draft did not excite me in the least. Like, maybe it's just me. But to me, like, there was an obvious pick at one, and then there were, like, a few pretty good prospect types, and I think once you hit, like, I don't know, 9-10 deep in this thing, I think it fell off a cliff. And
I think it fell off a cliff earlier than that, probably.
Okay, even more sour on the draft than I am.
I talked to several guys in our league, the BDL, prior to the draft. One, maybe two, kind of had a different take. They were not as down on this group of first year eligible players as I think most folks were. I don't really agree with that with that assessment. I think it certainly was, at least in my estimation, a weak draft. Like you and I were chatting yesterday. However, I mean, we know invariably someone will pop from round three or four or later in the draft, or maybe from even waivers. I mean, that's just how these things go. Someone will have a better showing in their first full season in the minors than anyone anticipated, fly up fantasy prospect rankings and be the surprise that comes out of this class. But really no telling who that is this time. I think, just as you mentioned, after you get out of the first several choices this year, it was a fairly shallow, fairly shallow draft. You know, I just made a few notes here and we can kind of bounce back and forth if you want, but, you know, I thought it was notable 5 picks in the first round for the Sactown Swamp Dogs, and for everything we might say about the, shallowness of this draft, I still think that the Swamp Dogs, made excellent use of their choices.
Yeah, I thought
really
so.
Liked their picks. Of course, Bizzano falling to them, the second baseman there in the first round. Nick Kurtz, second baseman. Nick Kurtz, the first baseman, great grab.
Condon at nine surprised me.
Condon at nine. You know, he didn't, you know, he didn't jump out of the gate screaming when he entered the minor leagues in this back half of 2024 there. And I think that certainly hurt his fantasy draft stock in this draft, but still relative to the depth of this draft, Condon at nine is a freaking steal. So good for the Swamp Dogs there. Two more later in the round, including shortstop Bryce Rayner, was really impressed with what the Swamp Dogs were able to pull off with their draft capital investment. And, you know, you can maybe say that the Disposable Heroes claimed a better haul in round one due to having consecutive picks from 5 to 8 in the round. And they did very well. Cam Smith, Connor Griffin, Chase Burns, Christian Moore. That's in no particular order there. But, you know, it's of course, easier to draft from the top half of the first round. So setting that aside, I really liked the Sactown choices from a volume standpoint relative to the quality of this draft, Mike.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I thought he did really well. As for the Heroes, they had picks 5 to 8. And when I saw who they picked, again, I have no issue with any of these players, but my overall feeling was if I got picked 5 to 8 in a draft, I'm expecting to come out of that with a couple guys I'm pretty certain on.
You would hope.
I'm not certain on any of those guys.
I agree with you.
And and it just seems like it just as a comp, pick number 2 that went to the Wallabies, J.J. Weatherholt. I believe in MLB Pipeline's top 100, he's actually behind the guy that went number 11 on our draft. Just to give a feel for, you know, there just didn't seem to be an obvious, you know, I don't know, even top 4 or 5 guys in this draft. Like, I like Sasaki.
Yeah.
Bizzano seems as close to a sure thing outside of Sasaki that there was in this draft. And outside of that, it just felt like we were just kind of picking and hoping with a lot of these picks.
Sure, sure.
Which is my usual draft strategy when I pick, picking and hoping. But it just didn't strike me as a particularly what's the word I'm looking for? You typically have some level of certainty when you're picking in, say, the first half of the first round, at least. And outside of pick 1, I don't think anyone can come out of this draft having any sort of certainty with who they took.
I agree. I did make a few notes here, just a few more standout picks in my mind throughout the remainder of the draft. And Mike, I don't know if you took time to do the same. We don't have to do that. But I'll just run through. I have, I think, 5 or 6 jotted down that that I particularly thought were great value picks at that time. One or two, maybe a little bit of a possibly a reach, but again, given the talent level or perceived talent level in this draft, I don't even know that you can really say that. But the Vipers grabbed Griffin Burkholder, an outfielder, at number 19. I was quietly hoping Burkholder would, you know, go a little more unnoticed and possibly fall to me later in the draft, although I was pretty sure that that was not going to happen. But I really liked that pick by the Vipers. I also really liked the Moncton pick of Cash Mayfield at number 39, so much so that the Generals traded for him moments after the pick was made, if you were paying attention. So I did very much like that pick. Another Vipers pick I'll brag on, Michael, Cale Fountain, third baseman at number 45. I did think this gentleman, he did fall. Folks let him slip a little too far. I thought Fountain that deep into the third round was splendid value for Chula Vista. Cobb Hightower at number 55 to the Cardinals really liked that pick. Dorian Soto at number 66 to the Bears, not at all a bad grab near the top of round five in my view. And I'll round this up with another Mounties pick that I happen to really like. They swiped Guardians pitcher Joey Oakey in the fifth round at number 72. Oakey had no business at all slipping that far in a relatively shallow draft. So good for Steven on that one.
Yep. To be honest, the three picks that kind of stood out to me were all in the fifth round. Two of them happened to be mine. Just happened to be the way this worked out. But it was really awful. I didn't like it. Like, and to be honest, I hated some of my earlier picks. It was more like, all right, I'll take this guy who's a prospect, but I really don't think much of him. But I'll take him anyways. But for me, the three picks that kind of stood out were Chris took Zach Littell in the middle of the fifth round. He had a really nice season last year. Again, is he a star pitcher? No, but pitching is at such a premium in this league.
Yeah.
And if he gets anywhere near replicating the numbers he put up last year, that's an absolute steal where he picked him up.
Agree.
And then two of the picks that I made, and it just happens that I made them, one of them was Ryan Pressly. And now that was just a complete fluke. As I was getting on the clock, there was I can't remember which reporter on Twitter had leaked that a trade to the Cubs was imminent. And I just happened to be on the clock just as that news was leaking. And I'm there, is he owned in our league? And I went, I'm there, no, he is not. I'm there, you know what? This guy's probably going to be a closer in a pretty decent team. And when you get him with like the, I don't know, 74th pick or whatever it was, That's about as good a value as you're going to find.
Oh, no. Listen, after you get beyond the first, you know, two, three, four picks in this draft, you can make a real argument that choice of Pressly was the best pick in the entire draft.
Yeah.
Just in terms of major
league. It's just a complete fluke. I just happen to be in the clock. Yes, but I'll take it.
Yeah, listen, you threw a dart and it hit the board. I mean, that's all that matters. You know, I'll just state for the record, when I was kind of making these notes and looking at my choices for picks I really liked, I was focusing only on prospects,
of course, the prospects,
players.
Yes.
So that's why I didn't include. I mean, you know, again, I agree totally with, you know, especially the Pressly pick was, you know, it's going to probably pay dividends for the Rockets in this season. So,
yeah. And then my last pick of the draft, funnily enough, is a guy named Yaro Padilla. I don't know who this guy is, but I got three trade offers for him in the 48 hours following our draft.
Hmm.
And I was wondering what is going on. And then I have a Baseball America subscription, and I guess they wrote a piece on him, you know, basically, you know, prospect to watch with helium sort of thing. Uh-huh. And then the second they wrote about it, two other of these prospect websites apparently also wrote pieces about this guy being a top 50 prospect in 12 months. And okay, this explains the offers. All right. So fair I have enough. No idea if he's going to be any good or not. It just seems to be one of these guys that's got helium on him, which either means he's going to be a top 50 guy in 6 months or no one's going to know who he is in 6 months. I have no idea which of those two it is, but it's going to be one or the other, I'm pretty sure. So.
That's how this goes. That's how this goes. Another BDL draft in the books. It was a great draft. Thanks for everyone in the league for making it a great draft. So we'll close the book on that topic. And right now we're going to throw it on over to our next segment and our special guest, The Race, Two Decades in the Making in the BDL, featuring special guest Brian of the Crawford Gramps. All right, guys, here we are. The Race, Two Decades in the Making in the Black Diamond League with Brian and the Crawford Gramps. Our friend Brian, buddy, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Hello from hurricane ravaged Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, man. Yeah, been a rough several months. I know that. I actually had to be in Greenville. I guess that was back in December, so didn't see a lot, of the very hard hit areas, but drove through a little bit of it here and there, and it was not great, but glad you guys are.
It has been a trip. Yeah.
Guys, fun little quirk of this segment. Brian actually does not know the reason that we invited him onto today's show. So he's learning in real time the magnitude of the 2025 season here in the BDL, along with each and every listener. So I'm just going to lay it out, Brian. So here we go. This year in the BDL, it's the race to 2,000. Two owners are knocking on the door of 2,000 all-time regular season wins in the Black Diamond League, and both owners are very likely to cross the 2,000 win mark this year. Brian, you and your Crawford Cramps represent one of the two. The other, none other than I'll just go ahead and say it, your longtime rival, Bill of the Disposable Heroes of Orion. So by the numbers, just a little setup, by the numbers, here we go. Here's what we're looking at. Bill needs 73 wins to reach 2,000. For context, he won 85 games last year in 2024. Brian, you need 121 wins. You're a little behind, Bill. You need 121 wins to reach the milestone here in this upcoming 2025 season. You won, of course, 135 games last year. So looking at anticipated wins in the upcoming year, not only are both owners and expected to hit the 2,000 win mark, but it's very possible this will be a photo finish to 2,000. The Cramps, I don't think anyone would argue are going to outpace the Disposable Heroes in wins this year. I don't think there's any question of that, but the Heroes are also likely to add, I feel, to their win total from last year as that club continues to grow following its rebuild. So this is going to be a fun summer and a fun race to watch. I just want to pause here for a moment and Brian, give you an opportunity just to react to the news of your impending accomplishment. That's literally, and I'll underscore this, two decades in the making here in the BDL.
I mean, I really don't have words for this. I'm thinking, it's so incredibly appropriate that Bill and I would be, running towards the finish line, for this BDL record together. He and I have been rivals since we first came into the league and got our teams established. We came in right around the same time. I think Bill was a little bit behind me in terms of BDL membership, but, his team has always been really tough, and I think it's really appropriate that he and I are kind of gunning for this. It's fun. Gives a lot of little extra context to the league this year, and I will make one prediction. I will get I will get to 2000 before Bill does.
There we go. That's what we hope to hear today.
You know what's funny, Scotty? What's that? If they have the exact same season they had last year, this is a very real chance they get to 2000 the exact same week.
That's crazy. And I had done some very rough math on that as well, Mike. And my brain just started to like bend a little bit. I was like, this is already a big story, but just the way this is coming together, it's kind of like a Sosa McGuire, little thing happening in the BDL. And that's just so neat. Before we get any further, I do want to note just for the record, we did reach out to Bill and hoped to have him on the show today as well. But due to scheduling conflicts, he just couldn't be with us. But Bill, early, probably congratulations to you as well. And again, this is going to be just a really fun story to follow. And in case you're curious, just a little more back context, and I'm kind of a nerd for this stuff with the BDL. So just bear with me.
You certainly are.
Thank you. Brian has held continuous control of the Cramps franchise since March of 2006. That's just wild to even say. His first game credited in the BDL came on April 2nd of that year, which was the start of the season. Bill, on the other hand, is 1 year behind Brian in terms of tenure, with his first game in the BDL credited at the start of the following season on April the 1st, 2007. And yes, I do keep records for all that stuff. So with all due respect to Brian, Bill and Brian, you've already alluded to this a little bit. You know, Bill has actually cut, a little better pace in route to 2000. So also one more housekeeping note for the record. I just do want to make this plain. We do realize here on the show that CBS Sportsline, which is our longtime provider, keeps certain quote unquote records on the league site, but for a variety of reasons, not all of those are accurate. And that does apply to all time standings. The CBS standings, the historical standings, don't take into account the precise moments in ownership change occurred in the BDL at any given time, and other little nuances of record keeping, such as how we handle the 2020 COVID season here in the BDL and things like that. So the league office maintains an official vetted spreadsheet of such things. And I have those numbers in front of me now relative to this conversation. So again, just want to set this up a little bit. Most wins in regular season BDL history. I've made a list. I've got the top 12 in front of me. I cut it off at 12, or I went as deep as 12, because I went down. I included the owners who have collected 1,000 wins or more in the BDL. 1,000 wins or more. So there are 12 owners who are above that mark. Of course, we've already talked about Bill. He is currently at in first place, 1,927 wins. Again, we mentioned needs 73 more. And Brian, right now at number two, 1,879 total wins, needs 121 wins to reach 2,000. Probably some obvious candidates I know here at three. Do either of you want to take a guess who the number three all-time wins leader for regular season victories in the BDL is?
Oh, wow. It's who? Johnny.
Very good. Johnny. It is Johnny of the Killer Car Company. Nice. He is behind... not that far behind. Johnny will have his moment here in the upcoming couple of seasons, or should, currently with 1,808 wins, followed by myself, Scotty, number four, with 1,768 wins. Mike is right behind me. We are 8 wins apart, Mike, you and I. You have 1,760 all-time
wins. And three seasons, too, Scotty.
You pulled that off in three seasons?
No. I'm saying I think you started 3 years before I did.
Two seasons. I have two head-to-head years on you. Yes, that's okay. Correct.
So if I go 8-320 over the next 2 years,
okay. So in all fairness, you are cutting a better pace than I have historically cut. That is true.
A little bit, yeah. We bet.
Right now I am ahead.
There you are. There you go.
That's all that matters.
You know what's funny, Scotty? I theoretically might never catch you. Like it's within the realm of possibility. Your team goes on a run now and just kind of put some space between us. So let's.
Yeah, we'll be.
I'm kind of hoping to catch you at some point. Yeah, I'm kind of hoping just to catch you at some point this year, just so I can point it out.
Number six all time is Brent of the Wallabies. He has exactly 1,700 wins. Mm-hmm. Number seven, Ort, the Elevation course, dropping down into the 1500s, 1549, followed by Joe of the Amish Brotherhood, 1541. John, our old buddy John of the Woo, slipping in there at 1346. Chris of the Beers right behind him, 1316. Mark of the Rebels, 1310. And then finally, Kevin of the Double Downs, 1,256 wins. So that's the top 12, and those are the 12 owners in the history of the BDL who have so far collected at least 1,000 wins in our history. So, Brian, is there any doubt? And you've already addressed this, I know, but I'm just going to go ahead and ask it again. Is there any doubt in your mind about Crawford's ability to capture 120 wins this season? For context, the Cramps haven't won fewer than 130 games dating back to 2019. So you've been on a stretch run of excellence lately.
Kind of just laying the jinx on you, nice and
Hey, there it is. Try
did you hear what he did in the setup of that question, Brian? Just to mess with some more. He said, do you think you can get to 120 wins?
Mm-hmm.
120 gets you to 1999. Just a jerk to say it that way.
Yeah, that sucks. Barring injury, I think I hit that number easily this year. That's always a wild card. You know, we've all had years when our teams are completely wrecked and we can't even field a healthy lineup, and that happens. But if that does not happen, I definitely expect to take the division and to easily eclipse this wins mark. That said, you know, weird stuff happens in the BDL. You never know.
That it does. Mike, I'll throw this one to you since Bill is in your very competitive division, as we all know, mm-hmm. the East Division. I know the Heroes, of course, are on the upswing in the BDL. As we've already mentioned, they won 85 games last year after winning only 44 the prior season. Is it possible, from your perspective, that the meat grinder environment that is the BDL East could even prevent Bill from reaching his needed 73 wins this year?
Is it possible? Yeah. Is it likely? Nah. Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, I would land there too. I think that they're not going to win a lot of games this year, but that Bill's team is going to be really good and really soon. I just don't think it's this year. I think you give him another couple of years, and you're looking at a very strong contender for a long time.
Yeah.
You
if I had to set the over under, Scotty, I'd probably put him somewhere in the mid 80s if I had to set the over under.
Yeah. Bill has, you know, it's, and I hope I'm not pulling back the curtain a little too far on this and sharing things maybe he doesn't want me to share. But, you know, Bill and I had a phone conversation or two several years ago when he was kind of at a crossroads with his club and you know, was kicking around ideas of, you know, if you wanted to just keep the pedal to the metal and trying to win, or, you know, take a hard nosedive into his first strong full rebuild here in the BDL. And, of course, settled on that decision. And as we all know, entered that rebuild period. And I just have to say, you know, we had only seen the version of Bill in the league who won games. We had not actually seen him go through this process and rebuild a club, tear it down, build it back up, which is harder than folks think to do, I believe. And Bill has done an obnoxiously good job accomplishing that goal. Yes, his rebuild has been honestly spectacular. And I hate it. So there's that. I say all that to say, Brian, I agree with you. I think he's going to be a contender again, you know, probably not this year, but very soon.
Yeah. I would just want to throw in the fact that I think there are two people who are rebuilding their teams properly, you know, and doing it in a way that just like really kind of opens your eyes and makes you say, wow, those two teams in very short order are going to be very good. And in my opinion, it's Bill, of course, and he has had more patience than I would have. He's going to have a very good team, but also I like the job that Brent's doing.
I think this is, boy, we could maybe have some fun with this comment, because I think there's a little bit of an impression in the league. Maybe I'm wrong. I think there's a little bit of an impression that Brent is dropping the football on this rebuild. And I just don't agree with that at all.
I don't either.
I agree with you, Brian. I think he, you know, Brent is, you know, with him, we've seen this before in his Wallabies. He does have a kind of a quirky, different way of rebuilding, but he's done this multiple times in the past and has found his way back to success and winning division titles and contending. I like a lot of his moves. He's got some great pieces, Roman Anthony and others, you know, coming up as early as this season. And I know we're getting wildly off topic here, but I mean, I do. I think the Wallabies' job so far has been very underrated.
I concur. Mike's, I think he's been a great comment. Job.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, Brent, though, he'll ask about certain players on my team, and he'll just like send me a text or whatever, or sometimes I'll have a crazy idea and send him a text. But it's like the players he asks about are the exact guys that I really want to keep, and they're like under the radar, and I just think Brent really gets it in terms of who's going to be a fantasy contributor versus who's going to, you know, wash out before they ever get to the major leagues. Mm-hmm. I think that's the secret of building a good team in the BDL. Be honest
for
with you.
Sure, for sure.
Yeah, Brent's reputation is what it is. Again, he is the Florida Marlins of the BDL. Every decade or so, he comes up and wins a title, and then it's like a 6-year nap. And then when no one thinks anything's going to happen, he kind of pops out of nowhere, wins a title. It's like, oh, and now it's nap time for 6 years again. That's just kind of how his team. And again, I don't know if that's by chance or by design. But that tends to be the way his team kind of runs, where it's like you don't really notice it for years on end, and then all of a sudden he's a contender for a couple of years, and then he goes into a long rebuild process and he does it again. So it's they are a less successful Gotham City Generals.
I'm not going to peel that onion on this show. We'll save that for later, maybe.
That kind of style where there are these kind of giant lulls where the team's not very good. The difference is when Scotty rebuilds, there's usually an extended run, where Brent's run is usually like a couple of years and then it goes into the lull again.
Yeah, I think his strength. I think his strength. And look, we can say this, and I know Brent's been in the league for.
Ever
very very long, yeah. Times. So there's, you know, I'm, you know, looking at the list, sixth all time in wins, 1,700 total. You know, you can say, you know, a lot of that is just because of longevity and he's been around for so long. But you know, you just go on down that list a few spots, and I'm not trying to throw shade at the Wrigleyville Woo here, but you know, John was in the league for, you know, not exactly the same amount of time as Brent, but not he didn't come in all that long after Brent, and those win totals are very different. All time win totals.
It's kind of faint praise. You're better than the Woo. You can set the bar a little higher than that. It's like
I'm trying
to beat me. You know, it's the equivalent of saying you can beat me in a foot race. Fantastic, good. Basically means that, you know, doing the race it didn't fall. That's effectively what it means.
Well, so, I'm trying to create the distinction here that it's I don't believe it's because of his longevity. There's more to it there. He is a former champion. Mm-hmm. He's won, you know, multiple division titles. And I think in his case, to Brian's point, you know, maybe Brent, and I would have to go back and look at the draft history to really confirm what I'm thinking, but maybe that club historically is not the best drafter per se, but I think Brent and actually Chris are very similar in this regard. They're both very, very, very skilled at identifying quality players who are either under the radar or who are great buy low candidates through the waiver wire, through small, seemingly meaningless trades. And then suddenly out of nowhere, they have assets that matter. I think those two owners are very, very good at that.
I agree. I think absolutely. And these players, who, you know, all of a sudden come out of nowhere and land, you know, pretty high on the top 100 list every spring. It's like, you want to see where those people came from. Well, smart people like Brent and Bill are cruising, you know, baseball stats and picking up guys with insane K rates, stuff like that. That's, you know, what a smart owner does. And those are owners who don't get awards for just, you know, showing up and letting us kick their ass. I mean, these guys are smart and they're trying to put together smart teams. And my prediction, Scotty and Mike, is that Brent is going to flip the switch the same way Scotty did after not last season, but the year before. Like the minute we get to the past the postseason, he's going to flip the switch. It may be this year, it might be next year, but he's going to suddenly begin to acquire assets that are not near major league ready, but assets that are big time major leaguers and who are going to put up numbers.
You guys are much higher in the Wallabies than I am.
Okay. Whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's,
I might be wrong. Like I've been wrong a lot. I just don't see it.
I'm not out here trying to bang a drum for Brent. It's in the Wallabies. It's not that. It's just, you know, I think there's a track record there that is often undersold. That's it.
That's fair. Yeah. You know, I think that's fair.
And, you know, speaking of, you know, longevity, it's kind of mind-boggling to consider, you know, the fact that the BDL has existed for a long enough period of time for us to be on the cusp of witnessing these momentous achievements. You know, getting back to Brian, Bill, we're talking about chasing success, chasing championships in the same fantasy league for, I'll say it again, 2 decades. I mean, we can say that.
It is crazy when you say that, Scotty. The thing that I always come back to is when I was invited into the league, I literally set my first lineup from a resort in Cuba that had dial-up internet. And my son was like 6 months old. And my son just got accepted to university, and I'm still in this league. It's pretty crazy when you look at it from that perspective.
Yeah. Go ahead, Brian. Sorry.
It's pretty cool. I was just going to say it's a testament to longevity. It's a testament to friendship. It's a testament to the competitive spirit. So I really, you know, I enjoy this league. I enjoy, you know, the company and all the people who I've played with over the years. Even, you know, I know Bill and I have a pretty good rivalry going. It was perhaps a bit better when we were in the same division and had the scratch and claw. I don't even remember who was in our division going way back in the day, but it was great fun, you know, playing against Bill. And I think that, you know, it's kind of what the BDL is about, is, you know, going for records because they mean something.
Yeah. Well, and I think to that point too, you know, again, we talk about, you know, this 20 plus year history now, and, you know, looking at achievements like these for you and Bill this season, you know, it's not that you've been here for so long. That's the impressive, you know, component here. It's the fact that you have been here that long consistently and doing this at such a high level across that amount of time that the 2000 win milestone is even within reach after 20 years. You know, we have, you know, these two guys we're talking about, Brian, Bill, have relative contemporaries in, you know, on the all-time list that we just discussed, who are not within reach of 2000 wins this season. Brent, Joe, Johnny, myself, John, you know, et cetera. It's impossible to know the answer to this. And I know it's a little silly maybe even to ponder about it, but I would truly someday love to just hear from other leagues, if they're out there, if that
oh yeah,
they have enjoyed similar longevity. You know, is there another fantasy baseball owner in the world today? And I know that sounds silly, but I mean, just really, if there's someone else in the world today that can show documented proof of having won 2000 regular season games in a continuously operating 10 category league. And I don't mean that from a competitive standpoint, you know, league to league. I would just genuinely, you know, love to have that person on the show just to talk about it and compare notes. I mean, it's just such a unique thing that I feel is probably unique to the BDL.
Yeah, I was, you know, I'm sitting here wondering if Mike has any idea, because you know, he's got some connections in the fantasy baseball world at this point. I wonder if there are, because I mean, you hear once in a while of like a league that goes back to the Stratomatic days or something. Well, we almost do. We go back to like the early days of fantasy baseball. You know, I think Sandbox was the biggest site on the internet and Yahoo when we were starting our league.
I think you're right.
It's kind of a miracle that we've been able to stick with CBS as our platform for this long, to be honest with you.
Well, through good times and bad with CBS, but we're still there.
I think to Brian's Brian's point, I think the only kind of league that you'll find that has this sort of longevity are leagues that were literally set up as home leagues with a bunch of people like in high school together. I think the amazing thing about our league, it's 20 years of guys that literally did not know each other before they joined this league.
Right,
like it's pretty amazing to me. Like I joined this league, 17 or 18 years ago. There's 8 guys that have been in this league with me this entire time. It's pretty amazing when you look at it that way. Like people that I did not know, you know, with the exception of Scotty, who I knew a bit, but you know, there's 8 people that have been doing the same thing in the same league for 17 or 18 straight years. It's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it.
So, guys, I have another question. Other than winning multiple BDL championships, you know, Mike, you and Bill both have 3. Brian, myself, Kevin of the Double Downs and Ern of the Helsinki Falcons, wherever he is today, all have 2.
Well, we know he ain't going to catch me. That's one guy we know. It's one guy I'm not worried about.
Is this the most important accomplishment to date in league history, putting multiple championships aside?
The 2000 wins?
Yes, 2000 wins.
I don't know. That's actually a really cool question because it does speak to, like, as you said, this isn't a longevity thing. This is a longevity plus quality thing.
Right.
And it's one thing I harp on all the bloody time is how impressive it is to be good for extended periods of time. And if you hit 2,000 wins, you're effectively saying you've been a 100-win team for the better part of 2 decades. And – I can speak to the difficulty of that. That's not bloody easy. So is it the most important record? You could certainly make a case for it. Like, I think it becomes more important because the people chasing the record also have 5 titles combined between them. Sure. Like if Bill and Brian had 0 titles and they were chasing after 2,000 wins, I would be like, yeah, it's a cool stat, but it doesn't mean as much. But I think the fact that, like, there's a decent chance if Brian gets the 2,000 wins this year, he might also be raising a third trophy at the same time. So I think that combination is the big thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather have the trophy for sure. But also, you know, and I don't want to sound boastful or anything, but I really, when we turned on the mics today, I wasn't sure what the topic of conversation was going to be. And this number really surprises me. The 2,000 wins thing. I mean, although, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, you know, I'm looking at the top 12 list here, and, you know, we've got Bill, me, Johnny, Scotty, Mike, Brent. That list does not surprise me at all. I think just the enormity of the number 2,000 is a little overwhelming to me right now. Sure. But it's fun. I think this year will be a lot of fun for the Cramps, and I hope that I can put together some long term pieces. But you know, I'm looking at this year and I'm thinking this is probably my best chance to win a title for a while. So 2,000 might be, and the third title might be nice to lock down, you know, the Cramps third championship and what have you. But I love the idea of gunning for both of those things in the same season.
It's going to be really among the coolest stories to follow that we have ever had in this league. You know, every now and then something floats by and we get to champion it and talk about it. And you know, when this jumped out to my eyeballs, you know, looking over the spreadsheet as I was working on some statistics over the off season, I just kind of it stopped me in my tracks. I mean, it really did. Just the enormity of the moment that is upcoming for these two owners who have, you know, been with us through thick and thin, through ownership changes, you know, in other divisions within the BDL. And, you know, it's just, Brian, I agree. I mean, you put it, you know, you've articulated it, I think, better than I could have. Just that, you know, the mental image, the visual of that number in your head, 2,000 wins in the regular season. It takes not only such a long time, but such dedication to get to that number, even after 20 years, you know, and it's just so impressive. And I think, you know, both of you here on the cusp of this, you know, ought to wear it like a true badge of honor. And, you know, just and coming, you know, coming from one of the, you know, commissioners in this league and of course the founder of this league, you know, I don't mind you just say here on air, I'm just so proud of you both. And I mean that genuinely, you know, that I'm happy for you. I wish it was me first, as always, because the competitor in me wants that.
And, Scotty, the good news is in 2029, when you get to 2,000 wins, that'll be a cool accomplishment for you. No problem.
Yeah.
One thing I'll point out, though. Remember, I started as the MP Outlaws. Where did Bill's team come from?
Seems like a
very smart lady had that team before he did. Had an awful lot of very nice young prospects.
Yep.
That I would have loved to have been the manager of.
But Brian,
hey Scotty, you know, I just thought of something though. When Bill changed his team name, didn't he make a big thing about this is a new club? This is a new start. This is a brand new team. He didn't want us to refer to them as the Damage anymore. I think we can make a case that Brian's really the only team chasing for 2,000 this year because the Damage died a number of years back. Right, no, Brian? That sounds fair, doesn't it?
No. Okay. So you're going to make me pull up my spreadsheet here and give you a lesson on BDL team lineage.
Oh, no.
I mean, we could look at varying examples of this over the years. Hold on, I'll find something. Nope, not that one. Not that one. Not that one. Not that one. That's a change. Let's see, where are they all at? Darn it. Yeah, sure. Okay, here's one. Ort, our good buddy Ort, How many different team names has Ort had?
He changed like every year for five straight years.
Like the Billy Goats.
Yeah.
So he was. So he was
a Beltway Billy Goats.
That club has been the Kill Devil Hills Elevation since 2010, according to my records. It actually started out not as the Billy Goats, but as the East Side Idiots.
Idiots.
And quickly transitioned to the Beltway Billy Goats, and then finally the Elevation. And we've already mentioned Earn already once in the pod, but that's no different there. He was the Farsta Falcons and later the Helsinki Falcons.
Every time people move, they seem to feel the need to change their team names for some reason.
And don't forget, there was first the Milwaukee Beers.
Before the Malibu Bay Beers.
Yeah. This is not uncommon in the BDL.
Come to think of it, how many teams have just stuck to one name the entire time?
Oh boy. Let me look.
The Generals, there's the Cramps, there's the Rockets.
One team name the whole time. Hold on. Yeah. I'm pulling up.
It's a short list.
So we got the Cramps. We've got the Killer Cars, the Generals.
No, the Killer Cars changed their name, weren't they? Weren't they the Killer Cars of Anaheim or whatever, and then they tweaked it?
So I think by league policy, we started requiring clubs to include a city, a location.
Okay. All right.
There was a name change. It's just that they adopted. It's an addition.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah. I don't really see that as the same.
Okay.
The Wallabies, the same, the Amish Brotherhood, the same. Probably should have changed that name a long time ago. the Woo never changed. Mm-hmm. The Double Downs have not changed. I mean, you're getting into some folks who are, they're around, but they haven't been around for a long enough to factor into the conversation.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. The Cardinals, the Chicks, folks like that, it's not been long enough maybe. But.
Yeah. And the Chicks don't matter. Yeah.
It's darn right.
Always have to throw one shot in whenever
darn
we can.
Darn right.
The origin of Cramp's name involved George W. Bush's ranch.
Wow.
Yeah. When
it's coming that is not something I would have expected.
Yeah. Well, that's Crawford.
That's Crawford, nuts. Texas. Oh, yeah, Crawford. Exactly. Crawford, Texas. I guess that makes sense. Yeah. That's where you actually got that from, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If there's one president I wouldn't have thought you named your team after a piece of real estate he owned, that would have been one of them.
Yeah. I don't know. For whatever reason, I just liked it. It stuck.
We'll figure.
Okay, that's fun fact that I didn't see coming. Brian, while we have you here, I do want to chat, briefly about the upcoming season for the Cramps and the West Division as a whole. I'd like to start with your new competition in the West and just ask how you feel about the reintroduction of the Baltimore Epidemic and how that impacts the competitive balance in your division. And does having another win now focused owner out West, does it put you on notice?
Well, yeah. I mean, Matt's a smart guy and he's been in the league before. He knows how to do this. I really feel like, the level of competition went way up when Matt stepped back in, and put down the flag in Baltimore again. He's looking to win now. He's looking for innings for his squad and he's going to try to compete this league. This season, for the West Division Championship. So I felt like that was a surprise to me, Matt coming back in. And the first thing I thought was, okay, the West just got tougher.
Mm-hmm. So you've had really a death grip on the West Division now for four going on five seasons, even with the epidemic crashing the party. And the Elevation always hanging around, kind of waiting to strike. I don't think anyone would argue that the Cramps aren't the favorites in the division heading into this season. It's difficult to find a weakness in your offense, frankly. How much longer do you realistically believe your championship window is open?
Well, you know, this has happened before. When you get bored with a team, sometimes you just start to turn it over and sell it off and get pieces that you like better. You know, I definitely have had that happened once before in the Cram's history. I don't necessarily know that I, you know, obviously there are some areas like catcher and first base that probably will eventually need to be addressed. But, you know, when you have a 24-year-old Juan Soto in the outfield, 26, you really kind of have to think, well, you know, this might not be a 1 or 2 year window. In the division where I am, it's honestly a little cushy. Has been. It's going to get tougher. Yeah, I mean it's going to get tougher. Yeah, but I don't know with this team. I'm just going to run them out there. From what I've seen with my management skills, when I start to tweak a team and juggle my lineups, all I do is screw it up. So, yeah, I'm going to put it on autopilot this year and just see where we end up at.
Well, based on what I've observed, the Swap Dogs, speaking of one of your division rivals, rivals, probably too strong of a word at this stage, but the Swap Dogs might be orchestrating one of the more impressively quiet rebuilds in league history. Certainly not ready to make a run at Crawford. We all know that, but that club might be punching up fairly soon. Setting the Cramps aside, what do you think the upper half of the division looks like in 2 or 3 seasons?
Oh, that's a great question. I definitely see Baltimore hanging around. You know, I've always had problems with Ort's teams over the years. I cannot for the life of me figure out how he wins as many games as he does. And then he comes in and he beats me twice a year. So, you know, it's one of those mysteries. But I always see Ort being tough. Sacktown has got some really nice looking players though. You know, you like you said, they've been kind of quiet, but then you look at their team and they've got a player at every position. And, you know, we know that the secret to success in the BDL is spreading your risk and running up as many numbers as you can at certain positions and try to get to obscene totals that your opponent can't match, right? Ort does it with pitching every season. He's just got like tons and tons and tons. And you don't even know where these guys have come from, but here they're pitching in the major leagues and they're putting up innings and strikeouts against your team all of a sudden. I mean, it's a tough thing to navigate teams like that. But I see all these teams, you know, sort of jockeying up more towards the 500 totals. And I don't know where those victories necessarily come from, but I think it's going to be fun to watch and see if these teams that we see as having a really bright future, whether that continues. I happen to think it will, because we've got some smart owners in this league and some guys who are really putting in effort to look at scouting reports, to look at statistics, to read articles online and see what they can find out about these guys. But I definitely see, you know, maybe myself moving down as time goes on and some of these other teams starting to move up. We'll see.
Yeah, I think the West really has a chance to become, you know, kind of a baby East within 24 months or so. I can really see that as a reality.
Yep, I do too. I think Derek is one of the best new owners we've added to the league in quite a while.
I agree.
The thing with Ort's team's always going to be about 500. They're just how they are. Yeah. So they're basically just like the constant where, you know, they're not going to be amazing, but they're always going to be competitive. And Matt's track record kind of speaks for itself. Like, he came into the league years back and he got good pretty quickly and he stayed good for pretty much the entire of his run. So I can see that team kind of becoming like what Scotty said, you know, kind of a mini East where you have one really dominant team, but then you have three other teams that are constantly fighting for the playoffs. I can certainly see that.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a plan, and that's, you know, it's something you don't see in every single division.
Oh, you certainly do not see that in every division. You're right, Brian. I didn't say anything. I just said you don't see. All I did was echo back his words to him. That's all I did, Scotty.
You are not wrong.
Where you went with that in your own head is your own problem, Scott.
Brian, you executed a fairly significant deal with the Double Downs in August, I believe, which saw Bobichette, Hedgerway, and of course several other pieces in the package there. We won't recap the whole thing, but I imagine you viewed that deal as a shoring up of your roster prior to the playoffs.
Yes.
And it almost paid off as you, of course, did advance to the BDL finals last year, but you got unfortunately whacked by those same Double Downs in the championship series. No offense. The Cramps had won. I looked at this earlier. The Cramps had won 7 straight matchups heading into the finals last year. So you were on quite a run, even with, if I recall, your a bit of a depleted rotation around that time of year, battling some injuries. Were you feeling pretty good about your chances to pull off the rare BDL championship back-to-back?
Man, the finals last year were such a wasted opportunity for the Cramps. It was painful losing to Boston. And especially, because we had pulled off this trade earlier and he was using my players against me in some cases.
That's always fun. That's always fun painful. When that happens. Yep.
Absolutely. You're right, Mike. It was really tough. But one of the reasons I did that deal was because I really didn't have a guy who was a star to play at shortstop. And I was looking towards this year and thinking, Bichette's having a really terrible year. That's an injury issue. He's going to be fine. He's going to be back to being the player he was. So even though he was a guy who was injured when I traded for him, he was supposed to come back at some point last season. Never did. Or maybe he came back for...
He played one game, Brian. Broke his finger.
Okay, one... All right. Yeah, I definitely missed it.
He came back for the calf injury. It was okay, good. Bull's back. Next game, he breaks his fingers out for the season. It's like, oh.
That's right. That's right. Yep, that's the story. But yeah, it was really tough. I did like that deal at the time that I made it. I still kind of think I like the deal for me because of Bichette mostly. I'm trading away a big bat like Salvador Perez always hurts. But I really did like the Bichette part of it. It seems like I picked up some pitching too. I can't recall who else was in the deal, to be honest with you. Sometimes I make trades just because I'm like, all right, you know what? This looks like a positive... a positive thing for my team at some point, so I'm just going to do it. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of those.
Sure. For the record, the 3 BDL clubs to pull off the back-to-back ever, the Falcons, the Damage, now the Heroes, and of course, unfortunately, Mike.
Everyone's favorite team, the Rockland Rockets.
Your Rockets. So
yes.
There's that. So I guess, Mike, unless you have anything else, we'll close with this last question. The list, Brian. Ohtani, Soto, Gerrit Cole, Jose Ramirez, Freddie Freeman. I could go on and on. The early 2020s Cramps have been dynamic in the BDL. Is this your favorite Crawford club ever?
I think it is. I think, there have been teams in the past that I've owned where I've liked the players. I've gotten them to a certain point where I'm competitive. And then I just, for whatever, call it boredom, call it just like not liking the players after they've traded to a team that I dislike, such as the Yankees. Soto, it's going to be better for me that he's playing for in Queens because my wife's a Mets fan. So we'll watch a lot of those games. I like Soto quite a bit. And he's the kind of player that Crawford in recent years really wants to have on their roster. And those are players that I like to hit for average. They can have a little bit of pop and they have some speed. And if you've got a Juan Soto type, or like you said, Ramirez, Ohtani is just unbelievable. He's a monster.
Yeah.
He's a luxury to have on your team. Even when he's not pitching like last year, you can just, kind of plug him in and leave him at DH and you don't have to worry about it. He's going to play every single day. So yeah, I think this is probably my favorite Cramps squad in quite a while. I'm really excited about this year because I think for the first time possibly ever in my career as a BDLer, this is the first time I think that I have enough pitching coming into the season. We'll see if I can keep it. Who knows?
Well, Brian, thanks again so much for joining today's show. I will stop short of saying congratulations this early. We don't know what will happen in the regular season, but Mike, I think I speak for both of us when I say the show and the entire league will be watching this year and this race between you and Bill with tremendous, tremendous interest.
Well, yeah, congratulations to Bill as well. And it's been a lot of fun getting to this point. You know, looking at the numbers we need to get to that 2,000, I'll predict that I'll get there first. But who knows? Bill could surprise us. Thanks, guys. It's been fun.
Thanks, Brian. Okay, that was great. Brian, thanks again so much for joining the show. Really fun conversation. It's just incredible to think, you know, the milestones that we're beginning to hit here in the BDL after so many years, you know, as a cohesive unit, playing fantasy baseball together, you know, going on more than 20 years now. It's really crazy. But, Mike, as we record this, we're a whopping 38 days away from the start of baseball season. Officially, I know you're a Blue Jays guy, so how about this news? The New York Post's John Heyman this week suggested a deal to extend Vlad Guerrero Jr., your boy, could land north of $400 million. Actually, he put it closer to $450 million. Mm-hmm. Good deal or bad deal for Toronto? What say you?
The Jays really have no other option but to try to lock him up at this point. Now, this would have been a much better idea, say, 24 months ago. You probably could have got him at about half the number. But they have put themselves in a position right now where the excitement level around the club is hovering around zero. But the one guy everybody in the city loves is Vladdy Jr. Yeah. So I can't – if they do not lock him up, or if they trade him or he leaves as a free agent – then the team president and general manager may as well just resign now and get the hell out of town. Because they will be about as popular as the Dallas Mavericks GM is right now.
I was going to say, the Mavericks of the AL East.
Yes, yes. Although, you know what's funny is I'm just reading a piece because they just signed Max Scherzer, you know, that 23-year-old arm.
Right.
And,
oh, yeah.
And his quote was, I was interested in coming to the Jays because they were all in on the 25 season. And I heard that, and my first thought was, okay, he must be coming here because of our more liberal drug policy, because they came in last place last year, and they've accomplished not a hell of a lot this offseason. So I don't know where this they're all in for 25 came from, but I did find that rather humorous.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. They really have no choice. I'm still unconvinced that Vlad isn't, you know, 10 or 15 percent overrated. But that's just...
That's because you're crazy.
Not a hill I'm willing to die on. So,
nah.
Yeah. Well, Mike, great show. Looking forward to the next time. Guys, tune in fact, next time for the annual BDL Vegas odds as we head toward the start of the 2025 BDL season. Mike, should we offer any spoilers? Nah, better not.
No. I'll offer one. I will offer one. There will not be a team from the South favorite to win the BDL championship. How's that for a spoiler?
I don't co-sign this.
Well, I'm the one who makes the odds, so I can assure you that will be the case.
Okay, I want to make sure everyone heard this. If you disagree with the odds, you blame Mike, not Scotty.
That's fine. Come yell at me. I don't mind.
Good deal. All right, that's it for today's show, guys. Mike, it's been a pleasure as always. We'll see you next time here on the Can-Am Super Show.
Good night, everybody.